Chapter 1. A World View. Racial, ethnic, and cultural differences among peoples play a major role in the events of our times, in countries around the world, and have played a major role in the long history of the human race. Both intergroup socioeconomic differences within a given country and larger differences on a world stage between nations or whole civilizations reflect large cultural differences that have pervaded history. The history of cultural differences among peoples enables us to understand not only how particular peoples differ, but also how cultural patterns in general affect the economic and social advancement of the human race. A particular people usually has its own particular set of skills for dealing with the economic and social necessities of life, and also its own particular set of values as to what are the higher and lower purposes of life. These sets of skills and values typically follow them wherever they go. Despite prevailing social science approaches which depict people as creatures of their surrounding environment, or as victims of social institutions immediately impinging on them, both emigrants and conquerors have carried their own patterns of skills and behavior, their cultures, to the farthest regions of the planet, in the most radically different societies, and these patterns have often persisted for generations, or even centuries. The role of a particular people's cultural equipment or human capital is much clearer in an international perspective than in the history of one country. If our view is limited to one country, then it may seem plausible, for example, to attribute the Jews' rise to prosperity and predominance in New York's garment industry to circumstances peculiar to that period of American history, when masses of Jewish immigrants arrived in New York. But if our vision encompasses an international perspective, a world view, then we see that Jews have been prominent, if not predominant, in the apparel industry over a period longer than the entire history of the United States, and in countries ranging from medieval Spain to modern Australia, from the Ottoman Empire to the Russian Empire, as well as in Argentina, Brazil, Germany, and Chile. Similarly, while a one-country analysis might make it seem plausible that Chinese retailers were once predominant in Jamaica for reasons peculiar to Jamaica, a worldview shows that they were also predominant in the same occupation in the Philippines, Malaysia, Thailand, Indonesia, Vietnam, Panama City, and Lima, Peru. Much the same story could be told of the Germans who pioneered in building pianos in colonial America, Tsarist Russia, France, Australia, and England. India's entrepreneurial Gujaratis have likewise been prominent or predominant in business enterprises from Fiji to virtually the entire eastern coast of the African continent, from Kenya to South Africa. Italian fishermen have plied their trade not only around the Mediterranean from Greece to Spain and North Africa, but also in San Francisco, Argentina, and Australia, just as Italian architects have designed structures ranging from the Kremlin to sewer systems in Argentina. Scots historically played a major role in the international diffusion of medical knowledge, having first established Europe's leading medical school in Edinburgh in 1726, and subsequently sent its physicians to settle from Russia to Virginia, with Edinburgh graduates establishing the first medical school in the United States in Philadelphia, as well as the medical school at King's College, later renamed Columbia University, and at Dartmouth. Innumerable other groups have become prominent or predominant in particular occupations in countries all over the planet. The even distribution or proportional representation of groups in occupations or institutions remains an intellectual construct defied by reality and society after society. Nor can this all be attributed to exclusions or discrimination, for often some powerless or even persecuted minorities predominate in prosperous occupations. Christians and Jews were explicitly second class under Islamic law for most of the long history of the Ottoman Empire, but they predominated in the commerce and industry of that empire, as well as in medical science. In Russia, under the Tsars, the German minority, about 1% of the population, constituted about 40% of the Russian army's high command in the 1880s, just as German generals had been prominent in the high command of the Roman legions, and generals of German ancestry led the American armies in both world wars of the 20th century, as well as in the Persian Gulf War of 1991. Group occupational patterns, repeated in country after country, are only one of numerous cultural patterns that follow racial or ethnic groups around the world. Viewing such groups internationally frees us from prevailing social science doctrines, which presuppose that a given nation is causally, and hence morally, responsible for whatever occupational, economic, or other patterns, disparities, or imbalances are found among the various groups within its borders. Differences among groups and even among subgroups within a given people, are the rule rather than the exception all over the planet, in matters within their control, as well as in matters influenced by decisions made about them by other individuals or institutions. Fertility rates, alcohol consumption, performance and behavior in school, suicide rates, and output per man hour are just some of the indicators of behavioral differences among racial and ethnic groups, whether in the same society or in different societies. Even in mundane, manual occupations, large intergroup differences have been common. In colonial Malaya, for example, Chinese workers on the rubber plantations collected sap from the trees at more than twice the rate of the Malay workers. Even when the larger society is oblivious to finer breakdowns of subgroups within a given group, when all blacks look alike, for example, the differences among these subgroups are often as large as the differences between the whole group and the general population. People of Scottish ancestry have long been among the more prosperous groups in the United States, but people of the same ancestry in the Appalachian region have also constituted one of the most enduring pockets of poverty among white Americans. As long as our view is confined to American society, it may be plausible to believe that objective conditions in Appalachia or the way people were treated there accounts for the anomaly. Indeed, prevailing social doctrines all but require that approach. Yet, if the history of the Scots is viewed internationally, then it becomes clear that the subgroup which settled in Appalachia differed culturally from other Scots before either boarded the ships to cross the Atlantic. Similarly, sharp differences can be found in the history of those emigrants from Japan who settled in Brazil, as compared to those who settled in the United States. During World War II, the Japanese living in the United States were treated much more harshly than the Japanese in Brazil, who did not suffer mass internment during the war, just as they had not suffered the severe discrimination experienced by Japanese Americans before the war. Yet the Japanese in the United States remained loyal Americans while the United States fought Japan, and the Japanese in Brazil remained strongly, even fanatically, pro-Japan. This is virtually inexplicable by the approach which sees groups as being shaped by the society around them and how it treats them. Yet it is readily understandable in terms of the cultural differences which existed between the two groups of Japanese before they left Japan. Cultures are not erased by crossing a political border or even an ocean, nor do they necessarily disappear in later generations which adopt the language, dress, and outward lifestyle of a country. The cultural history of the human race is not simply the sum of the discrete histories of particular groups, because groups interact in various ways, through trade, migration, or conquest, for example. The benefits of one group's cultural advantages spread to other groups. The most obvious way this happens is when products or services are interchanged. Sometimes the technology, or the knowledge behind the technology, also spreads. In addition, the interaction in itself tends to shatter cultural insularity, which can otherwise be stultifying. When the Moors conquered medieval Spain, for example, they brought not only the tangible products of Islamic civilization, but also its science and philosophy, as well as their concerns for the purity of the Arabic language. Under their cultural influence, Spanish Jews then turned their attention toward science and toward a similar concern for the Hebrew language. While much that the medieval Spanish Jews did initially in science either repeated or derived from the science of the Islamic world, the longer-run consequence of this cultural encounter was a reorientation of much Jewish intellectual endeavor, which in later times produced quite different and original scientific discoveries of their own. Much of the advancement of the human race has taken the form of such cross-cultural borrowings and influences. However, even to say that mankind has advanced, if only in particular spheres, is to say that some ways of doing things, some cultures, are better in some respects than others, that they are more effective for particular purposes. Plain and obvious as cultural differences in effectiveness in different fields should be, there has developed in recent times a reluctance or a squeamishness about discussing it, and some use the concept of cultural relativism to deny it. After archaeology and anthropology have revealed the cultural achievements of some groups once dismissed as primitive, and especially after the ravages of racism shocked the world when the Nazi death camps were exposed at the end of World War II, there has been an understandable revulsion at the idea of labeling any peoples or cultures superior or inferior. Yet Arabic numerals are not merely different from Roman numerals. They are superior to Roman numerals. Their superiority is evidenced by their worldwide acceptance, even in civilizations that derive from Rome. It is hard to imagine the distances encountered in astronomy or the complexities of advanced mathematics being expressed in Roman numerals, when even expressing the year of American independence, MDCCLXXVI, takes up more than twice the space required by Arabic numerals, and offers far more opportunities for errors because a compound Roman numeral either adds or subtracts individual numbers according to their place in the sequence. The Roman numbering system also lacked a zero, a defect of some importance to mathematicians. Numbers systems do not exist in a vacuum or as mere badges of cultural identity. They exist to facilitate mathematical analysis, and some systems facilitate it better than others. Other cultural features likewise exist to serve a social purpose, not simply to put a cultural label on people, and those purposes are often of enormous importance, sometimes matters of life and death. Early European settlers in Australia sometimes died of hunger or thirst in a wilderness where the Australian Aborigines had no trouble finding food or water. Perhaps the clearest and strongest indications of cultural advantages in particular fields have been the willingness of peoples in other cultures to abandon their own products or practices in favor of cultural imports. Guns have replaced bows and arrows all over the planet, as books have replaced scrolls. Bears of foreign cultures have been imported, temporarily or permanently, to impart new skills, and native youths have been sent abroad to acquire those skills in the lands of their origins. Both processes were used to create modern industry and technology in Japan, for example, and both processes have been going on in other countries for centuries. So has industrial espionage, despite being legislated against as far back as 1719 in Britain. The effectiveness of particular cultures for particular things can be of the highest importance. Much, perhaps most, of human history cannot be understood without understanding such things as the conquest of ancient Britain by the Roman legions against a vastly larger British military force, simply because the legions were a militarily superior organization from a more advanced society. It is not necessary to claim that a particular people or a particular culture is superior in all things or for all time. On the contrary, world leadership in science, technology, and organization has passed from one civilization to another over the centuries and millennia of human history. But neither is it necessary to deny the greater effectiveness of particular cultures for particular things at particular times and places, even if other contemporary cultures may be superior for some other things. Cultures are, of course, not spread randomly among the world's population, but are concentrated separately in different peoples, different racial or ethnic groups. Neither the races nor the cultures are pure, but both biological and cultural differences can be discussed in general terms that correspond, at least roughly, to a recognizable social reality. The term race was once widely used to distinguish the Irish from the English, or the Germans from the Slavs, as well as to distinguish groups more sharply differing in skin color, hair texture, and the like. In the post-World War II era, the concept of race has more often been applied to these latter, more visibly different categories, and ethnicity to different groups within the broader Caucasian, Negroid, or Mongoloid groupings. However, this dichotomy between race and ethnicity is misleading in its apparent precision. Neither race nor related concepts can be used in any scientifically precise sense to refer to the people inhabiting this planet today, after centuries of genetic intermixtures. The more generic term, race, will be used here in a loose sense to refer to a social phenomenon with a biological component, rather than make a dichotomy whose precision is illusory. Whatever the biological reality, race as a social concept is a powerful force uniting and dividing people. Whether visible on the physical surface or simply felt in the emotional depths, race provides the cohesive groupings in which cultures have been concentrated, transmitted, and carried around the world. However, the erosion of both racial and cultural distinctiveness has been as real as their persistence. A worldview of race and culture must encompass both, but it cannot regard any group as a tabula rasa on which a given surrounding society puts its own imprint, whether spontaneously or through social engineering. On the contrary, a worldview of race and culture makes possible a closer and more critical look at the vague and ambiguous concept, society. Is society, or the environment where people are currently living? Or does it include the influences of their ancestral lands, or perhaps other lands where they may have settled for centuries in between? Once environmental explanations of group behavior begin to take on this expansive concept of society, then a given country's causal or moral responsibility for current economic and social conditions within groups is correspondingly reduced, and hopes for major social changes in a short time through government policy become less realistic. Groups may change on their own, even if outsiders cannot mold them to predetermined patterns. How and why groups change is one of the questions to which the history of races and cultures offers clues. In a sufficiently long view, these changes have been profound, both among groups living as minorities among others, and groups living as separate nations. China was, for more than 1,000 years, far more advanced than Europe in technology and organization. Yet eventually, Europe overtook China in these respects, and has remained ahead for several centuries since. The history recorded is the history of peoples and nations, but the patterns that emerge are patterns of cultures. Even in a technological age, the diffusion of technology, as such, is not as important as the cultural receptivity of different nations, peoples, and cultures to that technology. Their ability to take the technology, make it their own, modify it to suit their own purposes and circumstances, and develop it further on their own. Some nations and peoples have done this to a far greater extent than others, many of the latter being content to consume the products of more advanced technology, or perhaps to imitate the machinery that produced these products, following in the wake of others who continue to advance the technological frontier. What a student of Asian social history said of that region of the world would apply far more broadly across the planet. Some groups have, with seeming ease, jumped straight from a primitive mode of life into an almost full participation in world thinking and world economy. Others, which for centuries have enjoyed a much higher culture, somehow fail to adapt themselves to new conditions. When British industrial technology was the leading technology of the world in the 18th and 19th centuries, not only the products of that technology, but also the productive machinery in which it was embodied spread around the planet, as British railroads and British textile machinery, for example, appeared on every inhabited continent. Yet some countries, such as the United States, seized upon this British technology and not only reproduced it, but also developed it and eventually overtook the British themselves in its further elaboration and progress. That this happened in the United States to a greater extent than in continental Europe, which also borrowed heavily from British technology, has been attributed to the fact that Americans not only spoke the same language as the British, but were also heirs of the same intellectual traditions and cultural orientations. Yet Japan seized upon Western technology in much the same way, and after decades of being technological copiers and producers of shoddy imitations of Western merchandise and machinery, eventually forged to the forefront of technology and became the world standard for quality in such fields as optics and automobiles. Neither similarities of race nor culture can explain this Japanese receptivity to Western technology. Yet clearly, not all of Asia was able or willing to make this transplanted portion of European culture their own. Nor has Japan been willing to imitate Western civilization in all things, and it has in many respects openly disdained many of the Western patterns of thought and behavior as social degeneracy. When European technology has been seized upon by people so different as Americans and Japanese, one the clear heir of the European culture and the other from a radically different culture and race, then it is clearly the cultural receptivity of different peoples which is crucial, rather than simply their initial similarity to those in the technological vanguard. This suggests that the diffusion of technology is not simply a process of making information available or even transferring the embodied technology itself to other lands. Rusting Western machinery and decaying Western factories in many third world countries, in the wake of massive international aid programs, are a monument to the fallacy of believing that technology transfer is simply a matter of access, rather than of cultural receptivity as well. Nor is it enough that isolated individuals in less developed nations become highly trained or even inventive in the new technology. A substratum of workers skilled in mechanical, electrical, and electronic technologies is often needed in the modern world, just as skilled craftsmen were an essential support for those in the forefront of earlier stages of industrial advancement. Without these and other complementary conditions, many highly trained individuals are not as productive, and some simply relocate from their own third world societies to more industrially advanced societies, where their knowledge and talents find readier outlets, greater support, and fuller appreciation and reward. This brain drain from the less developed to the more industrialized world is neither inevitable nor inherent in societal differences in technology or living standards. When Americans were learning British industrial techniques, or when the Japanese were learning Western techniques in general, this did not lead to a brain drain of Americans or Japanese to Europe, but led instead to a buildup of a technological elite in the United States and in Japan, and that in turn led to the technological development of these societies. Whether those individuals who master the more advanced culture of other societies will remain in their own country, applying their knowledge to the development of their own economy and society, or migrate to other countries that are more receptive, depends upon the culture of the home country and the political and economic decisions which facilitate or stifle the use of the new knowledge. In short, peoples are no more the creatures of the objective circumstances around them when it comes to international technological diffusion than in the case of domestic minorities. In both cases, the culture of the people themselves is a major factor in the outcome, even if the crucial feature of a particular culture is in some cases simply its receptivity to other cultures. Technology is, of course, not the sole determinant, even of economic progress. Differences in work habits, saving propensities, organizational skills, personal hygiene, attitudes, and self-discipline all influence end results, both economic and social. Differences in all these respects influence economic and social outcomes among different groups within a given country, as well as among the nations of the world. These differences, however, are not static. Cultures spread, whether by the assimilation of technology, the migrations of peoples, or the imposition of foreign cultures through conquest. It would be enormously valuable to understand just why and how some cultures have seized the initiative at various periods of history and have led the technological, scientific, or medical advancement of the human race. Unfortunately, at the current stage of social science, it is a struggle merely to establish that some cultures are in fact more productive in various ways than others, whether we are comparing the cultures of different nations or civilizations or the varying cultural achievements of different racial and ethnic groups within a given society. Yet differences have been the rule, rather than the exception, in countries around the world, though the magnitudes of these differences and the reactions to them have varied widely. Group differences. The most basic and straightforward attempts to understand the role that particular cultures have played in the advancement of particular groups, and ultimately of the human race, encounter formidable obstacles. A prime obstacle is the prevailing intellectual vision, which not only insists on a cultural relativism that denies that some cultures are more advanced than others, but which also treats group progress as a function of the way those groups are treated by society. While the actions of others have often had profound effects, whether on minority groups or on whole conquered nations, peoples are not mere creatures of other peoples, and their long-run fate especially is seldom determined by other people's policies. Influences from outside may indeed reshape a people, but seldom in a way directly controlled, or perhaps even predicted, by any particular individual or council of decision-makers. Despots may inflict enormous sufferings on a people without remaking them to the intended specifications. Even mass extermination can leave the survivors no more molded to the oppressor's desire than before, as the post-Holocaust Jews dramatically demonstrate, not least by the establishment of the modern state of Israel. Cultures involve attitudes, as well as skills, languages, and customs. Attempts to measure cultural differences between groups by attitude surveys, however, miss the crucial point that culture is expressed in behavior, not lip service. The values of a culture are revealed by the choices actually made and the sacrifices endured in pursuing some desired goals at the expense of other desired goals. The fact that many different groups may regard many of the same things as desirable does not mean that they will all exhibit the same patterns of trade-offs when actually confronted with the inevitable sacrifices of the real world, as distinguished from the costless choices of attitude surveys. Education and personal safety may be valued by a wide range of human beings in a great variety of cultures, but what they are prepared to do, to sacrifice in pursuit of those goals, varies enormously. Cultural relativism may be especially pernicious when technological or other backwardness is simply defined out of existence instead of being overcome concretely in the real world. The remarkable rise of Japan from technological backwardness in the mid-19th century to the first rank of industrial nations by the late 20th century was made possible by a painful awareness of their own backwardness by the Japanese of the Meiji era, and the determined and enduring efforts they made to overcome it in the generations that followed. To have defined this backwardness out of existence would have been to remove the basis for their historic achievements. Stereotypes. One of the obstacles to understanding what behavioral characteristics follow each group around the world is the widespread use of the term stereotypes to dismiss whatever observations or evidence may be cited as to distinguishing features of particular group behavior patterns. But behavior has consequences, and when these consequences are the same for the same groups in disparate settings, that is an empirical fact not to be waved aside. It is understandable that Russians might wish to explain away the remarkable success of German farmers in their midst by citing special dispensations granted the German emigrants by the Tsarist government. But when similar success is found repeatedly among German farmers in Australia, Mexico, Brazil, Honduras, the United States, Chile, and Paraguay, then that theory cannot bear the weight of that history. Similarly, to explain Chinese predominance in retailing in Jamaica by factors peculiar to Jamaica does not explain their predominance in retailing in numerous other societies on the opposite side of the planet. Despite such evidence from countries around the world, it has become a common rhetorical fashion to refer to particular groups as having been placed or forced into particular occupational niches by the larger society. For example, it has been claimed by a well-known specialist on ethnic groups that the position of middleman minorities is preordained by the relations of power and of production imposed by the ruling class. Such groups are ascribed to a niche, according to this view, and to attribute their position to their own cultural characteristics is mere reiteration of prevalent stereotypes. Yet, by some staggering coincidence, Argentina, Australia, the United States, Poland, Jamaica, Brazil, England, Curaçao, Russia, and other countries all chose to assign to Jews the role of middleman minority. Even if one were somehow able to believe in this incredible coincidence for the Jews, and for a similarly long list of countries for the overseas Chinese, the Gujarati Indians, and the Lebanese, the question would remain, how does society also assign the skills necessary in the niches to which it assigns groups? If Germans were somehow assigned the niche of piano makers in Russia, France, England, Australia, and the United States, how did that assignment tell them how to make pianos? The same question could be asked regarding Italian architects, Scottish medical pioneers, or Irish politicians, all in country after country, which supposedly assigned them to their various respective professions. The thesis that groups are assigned to a niche is also confronted by the uncomfortable fact that groups too small to be noticed by the larger society, Albanians in Australia or Macedonians in Canada, for example, likewise end up concentrated in special occupations. The small number of Koreans in the United States became noticeable only after they became concentrated in particular kinds of retail stores, in particular kinds of inner-city neighborhoods. Although the assignment thesis is a nebulous metaphor with no actual mechanism specified, and no empirical test of that thesis against alternative hypotheses, its survival may be explicable by its role as a buttress to the larger belief that observed patterns of group differences must be due to the surrounding society, and that society's stereotypes. But the presupposition of an absence of distinguishing group values and traits is as arbitrary as any stereotype. Even where the evidence for distinguishing characteristics consists not of empirical facts about fields of specialization in work or studies, or rates of alcoholism or business ownership, but rather of local observations about the industriousness or honesty of the Germans, for example, dismissing such observations as mere stereotypes becomes progressively less tenable when these presumed stereotypes occur in numerous countries as far apart as Brazil and Russia, or Australia and the United States, in an era before modern mass communications put these societies in touch with each other's stereotypes. Why would such distant and disparate societies have the same stereotypes about the same group if these were only stereotypes? Even within given societies, when the same beliefs about a given group appear among both insiders and outsiders, it is hard to explain this in terms of stereotypes based on ignorance. If the Chinese in Malaysia consider themselves frugal and the Malays consider them stingy, both are denoting the same behavior pattern, though with different connotations. Conversely, a remarkable range of economically less successful ethnic groups in countries around the world, the Assamese and Maharashtrians in India, the Hausa Fulani in Nigeria, Creoles in Trinidad, Malays in Malaysia, and Sinhalese in Sri Lanka, blame themselves for unprogressive attitudes and behavior patterns, which handicap them in competition with more aggressive, education-minded, or business-oriented groups in their respective countries. To cling to the stereotypes dogma in the face of multiplying examples of parallel observations about the same group's behavior in the most widely separated and diverse societies is hardly a basis for claims of being scientifically fastidious. Clearly, not every belief about every racial or ethnic group is to be accepted as true a priori. Where the implications of a belief can be tested against empirical evidence, then that must be done, and the belief rejected if it proves to be inconsistent with the facts. For example, the notion that middleman minorities cause prices and interest rates to be higher than they would be otherwise can be rejected for its inconsistency with such evidence as rising prices and higher interest rates after these minorities have been expelled. But equally, when the empirical evidence reinforces the belief, that too is not to be ignored or dogmatically dismissed. Even if all races all over the globe have identical innate potential, tangible economic and social results do not depend upon abstract potential, but on developed capabilities. The mere fact that different peoples and cultures have evolved in radically different geographical settings is alone enough to make similarity of skills virtually impossible. The peoples of the Himalayas have never had an equal opportunity to develop the skills of great seafaring nations. How would Eskimos have acquired the skills needed to process raw materials found only in the tropics? The continent of Europe has had virtually every geographical advantage over the continent of Africa, whether in navigable waterways, more fertile soil, more ample and reliable rainfall, and a climate that does not support the devastating tropical diseases so deadly to man and animals in Africa. The many deep and slow-moving rivers of Europe are a sharp contrast to the relatively few rivers in Africa, with the African rivers also being beset with rapids and waterfalls. Given the enormous importance of water transport, how could that fail to affect the economies and cultures of the two continents? Is it sheer coincidence that the poorer parts of Europe have been areas lacking these geographical advantages? Regions more remote from the sea and with rivers frozen a substantial part of the year, as in Russia, or regions with low-volume rivers and meager rainfall, like the Iberian Peninsula, or regions culturally and economically fractured by mountain barriers, as in the Balkans. Geographical disparities are, of course, just one of the many influences at work, but alone they are enough to make problematical any equality or identity of skills, or any equality of natural resources or cultural development. Nor is there any reason to presume that the numerous other factors at work, including accidents of history, are similar across the planet. Every society and every era does not have a Genghis Khan, any more than they all have the same deposits of petroleum, gold, or iron ore. All the ramifications of these differences defy enumeration, much less tracing in detail. But it would be a staggering coincidence if they all worked out in such a way as to produce such a uniformity of capabilities that we could confidently ascribe all observations of group differences to the bias of the observers and dismiss them as stereotypes. Economic differences. Economic differences between peoples are the most demonstrable, not only in terms of incomes or occupations, but also, to a considerable extent, in terms of productivity differences. As already noted, even among uneducated and unskilled rubber plantation laborers in colonial Malaya, those who were Chinese produced more than double the output of those who were Malay. Not surprisingly, the Chinese earned more than double the income of the Malays. Chinese plantation workers were also preferred to Indian plantation workers as far away as British Guyana. When railroads first began to be built in 19th century France, British laborers averaged 3 or 4 times as much earth moved as did the French laborers. National comparisons tell much the same story as comparisons between groups within the same society. Indeed, even the very large economic differences between nations may often understate the differences between the economic effectiveness of different cultures. The economic performance difference between the culture of Britain and the culture of the Iberian Peninsula, for example, cannot be assessed solely in terms of the economic history of Britain versus the economic history of Spain and Portugal, or even of transplanted British societies, such as Australia and Canada, versus transplanted Spanish or Portuguese societies, such as Argentina or Brazil. For much of the economic development of such countries as Argentina and Brazil has been spearheaded by technology and people from non-Iberian sources, whether from Britain, Germany, Japan, or other nations more economically advanced than Spain and Portugal. Similarly, much of the industrial and agricultural development of 19th century and early 20th century Russia was the work of people from outside the dominant Russian culture, domestic racial and ethnic minorities, such as the Germans and the Jews, as well as foreign capitalists and the technology they brought. Much of the industrial and commercial development of Southeast Asia has historically been largely the work of Europeans, Americans, and the overseas Chinese. In Africa, those newly independent nations which have driven out the Europeans, either by design or as a byproduct of their policies, have suffered economically, while those nations which have made efforts to retain Europeans have generally advanced. An ideal test of the relative economic or other effectiveness of different cultures would be what they achieve in isolation, without the help of people or technology from other cultures. But no such laboratory test is possible with the nations of today or of the past several centuries. What we can do is to recognize not merely the general complexities of history, but also, and more importantly, that the net effects of these complexities have tended to understate, rather than overstate, the consequences of cultural differences. The issue of cultural differences in economic effectiveness among various ethnic groups has been trivialized by some writers by simply defining differences in skills and performance as class differences, thereby enabling them to say that ethnic differences have no significant influence on economic outcomes once class differences are held constant. In other words, when you remove all the differences in skills and performance between groups, their economic earnings differentials tend also to disappear. Who would have thought otherwise? Calling capability differences class differences is a meretricious use of words, since class is not defined by skills. A millionaire through inheritance, with no economically meaningful skills, is not in the same social class as someone who is poverty-stricken and who has no economically meaningful skills. Conversely, a surgeon and an engineer may be in the same social class, though their skills are quite different. The incidence of economically valuable skills no doubt varies from class to class, but it likewise varies from ethnic group to ethnic group and from nation to nation. The difference is that ethnic groups and nations have an existence independent of arbitrary definitions based on skills. Moreover, some immigrant groups begin at a lower socioeconomic level than that of the surrounding population and eventually rise above them due to their skills, work habits, or other economic performance differences. They have changed class precisely because of their skills, capabilities, or performance. Educationally, some ethnic groups achieve performance levels in certain fields exceeding the performance levels of higher class individuals from other ethnic groups. This is clear on various mental tests, for example, where Asian American students from families with low incomes scored higher on the quantitative portion of the Scholastic Aptitude Test in 1981 than did Black American, Mexican American, and American Indian students from families earning several times as much. These complex intergroup patterns cannot be reduced to simple class differences. The desperate expedient of redefinition suggests how difficult it is to evade the reality of ethnic differences, and how much some wish to believe otherwise. Vast differences between the economic productivity of peoples from different cultures do not imply that these differences are permanent, much less hereditary. Early 19th century Germans were clearly well behind the English in industrial technology, as demonstrated by their need to have the English not only build but even man the first railroads and steel mills in Germany. Yet within a century, the Germans had surpassed the English in industrial technology. So had the United States over the same span of time. Much the same story could be told of Japan, which moved from imitator to initiator over the same span of time. As just one example, the first Nikon camera, produced in 1948, was a blatant imitation of a German camera, the Contax, a camera later completely eclipsed, both technologically and commercially, by the further development of the Nikon by the Japanese. The normal tendency of economic processes is to disseminate technology, knowledge, and skills from their places of origin to where they are lacking. The law of diminishing returns means that the rewards of any factor of production tend to decline where that factor is abundant, and to be higher where it is more scarce. Like water seeking its own level, abundant factors tend to flow to where their scarcity makes their productivity and reward greater. Thus, capital, skills, organization, technology, or hard-working labor tend to flow toward regions and cultures where they are especially scarce. But the very scarcity and value of these skills and traits mean that those who possess them are likely to become more prosperous than the indigenous people of the recipient countries. Political reactions to these economic realities have often been negative and sometimes violent, as during the industrialization era in Tsarist Russia, when foreigners were hated, denounced, and sometimes physically attacked by Russians whose country they were developing. Among the myriad political responses to productivity differences have been measures to keep out or drive out the economically beneficial but politically offensive factors of production, even when that has meant brutal mass expulsions of peaceful human beings. This has happened on every continent and in many centuries, whether or not the resented people were physically different or indistinguishable to the naked eye. It has happened in affluent societies and in nations so poor as to be in desperate need of the very skills that are resented. The political mobilization of envy has led to legal restrictions on productive groups, preferential policies for those unable to compete with them, mass expulsions, confiscations, and mob violence. Such responses have been common in the most culturally diverse societies, whether directed against the Tamils in Sri Lanka, the Germans in Russia, the Japanese in Peru, the Igbos in northern Nigeria, the Chinese in Indonesia, the Jews in Germany, the Armenians in Turkey, or many other groups in many other places. The political perception of economic differences has implications which reach well beyond the domain of race and ethnicity. High productivity may contribute greatly to the material well-being, physical health, and cultural opportunities of a nation, and yet those responsible for that productivity may be resented, hated, and attacked both politically and physically. Down through the centuries and around the world, the bearers of the skills and disciplines that bring economic progress have been viewed as people whose prosperity has come at the expense of others. The repeated history of economic losses suffered by nations that expelled them has yet to teach a permanent lesson to the contrary. Those who have created economic enterprises are depicted politically as having taken over or monopolized economic activities that existed somehow. Their share in the additional output they created is depicted as a net loss to the economy, especially if any of it is spent in another country. Thus, the Indians of East Africa have been said to have acquired a stranglehold on the commerce and industry of that region, as if that commerce and industry existed independently of the Indians and simply fell victim to their malign influence. Much the same vision has been applied to the work of the overseas Chinese, the Jews, the Armenians, and others. The economic benefits created have been taken for granted, while the special prosperity of particular classes, nations, or ethnic groups who have established the industry and commerce from which these economic benefits flow have come to be regarded as suspicious or as demonstrably sinister. Technology transfer. Transference of the productive advantages of other cultures may be less socially resented or politically resisted when it is a transference of inanimate technology from country to country rather than a transference of flesh and blood people, whose very presence and prosperity raise troubling, invidious questions. Yet cultures vary widely in their receptivity to technology transfers, and especially in the extent to which their own people master this technology and begin to develop it themselves. Similarities between the technologically more advanced society and the society which receives its technology can facilitate this transfer, but some culturally very different society may also be receptive. British technology, for example, took root in both the United States and Japan. British textile manufacturing technology spread rapidly to the United States in the late 18th century, and British iron-making and steel-making technology and railroad technology spread equally rapidly to the United States in the 19th century. In textile manufacturing, the first spinning mule was smuggled into the United States from Britain in 1783, and a decade later, this and other textile machinery was being manufactured and sold in New York. The revolutionary Bessemer steel-making process, introduced in Britain in the 1850s, was so quickly mastered and improved in the United States that by the late 1870s, Americans were better steel producers than anyone in Europe. It took even less time, about a decade, for American mechanical engineers to produce locomotives that could compete with British locomotives and begin to drive the latter from the American market. Less than 5 years after the British produced pig iron with anthracite coal, Americans were doing the same. Technology transfer from Britain to the United States represented one end of a spectrum where both nations spoke the same language and shared very similar cultural traditions and mental habits. Even so, a considerable movement of people was involved, with American railroad locomotive production, for example, being due largely to a group of American engineers who had gone to Britain to observe and study British production methods. Technicians and craftsmen from Britain also went back and forth across the Atlantic to the United States during the early Industrial Revolution, acting as conduits of technology. Japan had a larger technological and cultural gap to overcome, but eventually it did so, and to a greater extent than some European nations or European offshoot societies overseas, which had more in common culturally with the British. One indication of the gap between Japan and the West when Commodore Perry opened this closed society to the world in the mid-19th century was the reaction of the samurai to whom he presented a gift of a scale-model train. At first, the Japanese watched the train fearfully from a safe distance, and when the engine began to move, they uttered cries of astonishment and drew in their breath. Before long, they were inspecting it closely, stroking it, and riding on it, and they kept this up throughout the day. A century later, the Japanese bullet train would be one of the technological wonders of the world, surpassing anything available in the United States. But before this happened, a major technological transformation had to take place in Japanese culture, opening the country up to the leading technology of the West, especially British technology, which led the world in the 19th century. During the early stages of the Industrial Revolution, when much technology developed out of practical experience rather than scientific understanding, the transfer of technology involved the movement of individuals with that practical experience. But while practical knowledge and experience were particularly important in the early phases of industrialization, with technicians and artisans playing a major role, the later rise of more sophisticated, science-based technology made formal education in these technologies, and in the sciences behind them, more important. This, in turn, made formal training a growing source of international technology transfers, as students from less industrialized nations increasingly studied in the universities and technical institutes of the most technologically advanced countries. These two methods of technology diffusion, as well as books, journals, and widespread industrial espionage, have long coexisted, but the proportions changed significantly over time. While formal training was expensive, trial and error learning was also expensive indirectly, whether in lesser efficiency or in outright damage to the equipment used. In 19th century Japan, for example, a technologically advanced cotton spinning mill imported from Britain fared worse than two smaller and simpler British mills imported at the same time, because Japan at that point in history lacked people with sufficiently sophisticated skills to maintain the more advanced technology. Japanese dyers, who used imported dyes without the necessary scientific knowledge, ruined fabrics until the Japanese government sent students overseas to learn chemistry. The incompetence of early Japanese engineers resulted in faulty designs for cotton mills, which required costly corrections after they were built. Even the more modest skills required of workmen were sufficiently lacking to lead to damaged machinery and costly shutdowns for repairs. With the passing years, however, Japanese skill levels began to rise. By 1880, most foreign engine drivers for locomotives in Japan were dismissed and replaced with Japanese who had mastered the craft. That same year, a Japanese engineer constructed a railroad line from Kyoto to Otsu with no help from foreign engineers. By the late 1890s, a whole cadre of British-trained Japanese engineers had emerged, and Japan was producing its own locomotives, which were comparable in quality to those manufactured in Britain or the United States. In the early stages of technology transfers, there has often been an accompanying transfer of people to install, operate, and maintain the equipment, as well as to train people in the country to which it is transferred. Thus, many technicians, workers, and foremen in 19th century French, German, Danish, and Russian shipyards were British. Tsarist Russia's industrialization program of the late 19th and early 20th centuries relied heavily on engineers, technicians, and workers from Western Europe and the United States, as did parts of the early communist economy. The countries to which technology is transferred may respond very differently, ranging from passive acceptance of the products or technology to an active involvement in adapting and further advancing the techniques they have learned and the scientific analysis behind those techniques. Much of the Third World has remained a passive recipient of modern products or modern technology, while Japan seized upon Western technology in the 19th century and later overtook the West in many respects by the late 20th century. The specific reasons why some cultures are more receptive and adaptive to various features of other cultures remains a question. What cannot be questioned seriously is that cultures vary greatly in this receptivity, as they do in many other ways. The issue is not one of access to technology, as has been naively believed even in responsible official circles, but what is done with that access. Emphasis on access is another of many evasions of causal responsibility by a people for their own situation. In an age of worldwide mass communication, books translated into innumerable languages international student exchanges, worldwide capital markets, and multinational corporations, access to technology is seldom the problem. What is also clear is that some cultures have been far in advance of others at a particular juncture in history, not just in isolated processes, but across a broad technological and intellectual front. Many centuries ago, Japan adapted from China not only the Chinese method of writing and Chinese philosophical ideas, but also such mundane things as the cultivation of cotton and the technology of its spinning and weaving. Today, the technological positions of the two countries are clearly reversed, again across a wide spectrum. A gap in technology has been equally real, large, and important in both eras, though without the permanence that might suggest innate differences in ability. Similarly, in Europe, Britain was largely a recipient of technological advances from the continent before the British became a net exporter of new technology toward the end of the 17th century and the beginning of the 18th. Here, too, the gap was not only large, but also covered a wide range of technologies. In medieval times, European civilization as a whole learned much from the Islamic world, also across a broad spectrum, from astronomy to philosophy, mathematics, crafts, and agriculture. And again, the direction of flow was reversed in later centuries. Sometimes a reversal takes place in a relatively short time, as history is measured. German engineers came to Britain to learn shipbuilding in the 19th century, but by the early 20th century, they came to teach. However varied the responses to technology from another culture, by and large, technology transfers seem to have been more readily accepted than the permanent transfers of human beings from another culture, especially when these immigrants continue to remain distinctive groups rather than assimilating. Put differently, there is less resentment of superior machinery than of people with superior skills. Yet even the machinery may be resented to some extent when its foreign origins or foreign ownership is taken as invidious reflections on the capabilities of the local inhabitants. In Argentina, for example, a national celebration was declared when the British-owned railroads became Argentine-owned. Cultural attitudes. Cultures differ not only in their accomplishments, but also in the attitudes which shape those accomplishments. These attitudes are much more related to economic outcomes, for example, than are much touted objective conditions as initial wealth or natural resources. Japan has prospered economically despite being nearly destitute of natural resources, while many third world nations languish in poverty on fertile land, well endowed with minerals, and with potential for hydroelectric power. Argentina once imported wheat, even though it had some of the finest land in the world for growing wheat, as subsequently demonstrated by immigrants from other cultures, who turned Argentina into one of the great wheat exporting nations of the world. Among the cultural attitudes which influence economic outcomes are attitudes toward education, toward business, and toward labor, especially so-called menial labor. Education. Education is one of those things which is almost universally desired across the most diverse cultures, and yet this deceptive universality conceals large differences between cultures as to what one is prepared to sacrifice in time, effort, and foregone pleasures to acquire what kind of education. In many third world countries, desperately needed scientific, technological, organizational, and entrepreneurial skills tend to be neglected in favor of education in easier subjects. Culturally different minorities in these countries, the Tamils in Sri Lanka or the Chinese in Malaysia, for example, often supply a disproportionate number, sometimes an absolute majority, of the students in mathematics, science, engineering, or medicine. Similar patterns are found in Latin America. A mid-20th century study of students at the University of São Paulo showed that students of non-Brazilian ethnic origin were more heavily concentrated in engineering, economics, and similar modern fields, while those of predominantly Brazilian family backgrounds were in more traditional areas, such as law and medicine. Similarly, at the University of Chile, people of German or Italian origin were prominent among the students in physics. In much of Latin America, technical and scientific careers were long regarded with condescension, with the result that a disproportionate amount of the industrialization of the region was done by immigrants and foreigners. Agricultural science has likewise tended to be neglected, even in predominantly agricultural nations of the Third World. In Nigeria, for example, more than 40% of the jobs for senior agricultural researchers were vacant at one time. In Senegal, it was 1979, nearly two decades after independence, before agriculture was even taught at the university level, though the University of Dakar had thousands of liberal arts students. In Malaysia, the Malay college students have tended to concentrate in the liberal arts, and many have ended up working for the government after graduation, for they lacked skills that would have a value in the economy. Nor is Malaysia unique in this respect. A cabinet member in Fiji declared frankly that the only use for the Fijian students coming out of their educational system was in government service to warm public chairs. In India, 3/4 of the college graduates have gone to work for the government, and a leading authority on Africa described African education as a machine for producing graduate bureaucrats. Indonesian youth have likewise turned after graduation toward bureaucratic careers, despite the warning of Indonesian novelist Ananta Tour that we must get rid of the silly idea of wanting to be government clerks. Government employment remains a prime objective and a prime source of intergroup conflict in underdeveloped countries around the world. Formal education, especially among peoples for whom it is rare or recent, often creates feelings of entitlement to rewards and exemption from many kinds of work. In India, for example, even the rudiments of an education have often been enough to create a reluctance to take any job involving work with one's hands. In the 1960s, it was estimated that there were more than 1 million educated unemployed in India who demonstrated a remarkable ability to sustain themselves even without gainful work, largely by relying on family assistance and support. Nor is this social phenomenon limited to India. Other third world nations have shown similar patterns. Such attitudes affect both the employed and the unemployed. Even those educated as engineers have often preferred desk jobs and tended to recoil from the prospect of physical contact with machines. In short, education can reduce an individual's productivity by the expectations and aversions it creates, as well as increase it by the skills and disciplines it may or may not engender. The specific kind of education, the nature of the individual who receives it, and the cultural values of the society itself all determine whether or to what extent there are net benefits from more schooling. Blindly processing more people through schools may not promote economic development and may well increase political instability. A society can be made ungovernable by the impossibility of satisfying those with a passionate sense of entitlement and without the skills or diligence to create the national wealth from which to redeem these expectations. The role of soft subject intellectuals, notably professors and school teachers, in fomenting internal strife and separatism, from the Basques in Spain to the French in Canada, adds another set of dangers of political instability from schooling without skills. It is understandable that third world peoples who have been ruled for generations by colonial bureaucrats sitting behind desks, wearing collar and tie and shuffling papers, should seek to imitate that role when they get the chance. But the wealth and power of the imperialist nation that put the colonial bureaucrat there in the first place was not created by sitting behind desks and shuffling papers. The science, the technology, the organization, discipline, and entrepreneurship that produced wealth and power usually did so thousands of miles away, beyond the sight of the colonial peoples, and these fundamentals are not primarily what they seek to imitate. Both in underdeveloped countries and among lagging groups in industrialized nations, there has developed a taste for easy, self-flattering courses such as Maori studies in New Zealand, Malay studies in Singapore, and a variety of ethnic studies in the United States. The claim is often made that the morale-boosting effects of such courses will enhance the student's academic performance in other fields, but this claim remains wholly unsubstantiated. What is clear is that easier courses, whether in ethnic studies or otherwise, prove attractive to students from lagging groups. Such patterns are found in many countries. For example, college students in India from untouchable caste backgrounds specialized in the easier, less prestigious, and less remunerated subjects. Similarly, just over half of those Soviet Central Asians who reached the higher educational levels specialized in the field of education. A similar pattern of seeking easier subjects and easier institutions has been found among Middle Eastern and North African Jews in Israel, as well as among Hispanics in the United States. Irish Catholics in Northern Ireland likewise show less interest in science and technology than the British Protestants there. Subsequent generations may begin to move into more difficult fields as their preparation and confidence improve. In the United States, those Black, Hispanic, and American Indian college students whose parents attended college before them have specialized in mathematical and scientific fields to a much greater extent than other members of their respective groups. and to an extent not very different from that found among other American college students. Occupations. Cultural attitudes toward commerce and industry have varied as much as attitudes toward education. A disdain for commerce and industry has, for example, been common for centuries among the Hispanic elite, both in Spain and in Latin America. Similar attitudes have been prevalent in the Portuguese colonial empire. Even those elites with vast wealth have tended to have that wealth in landholdings, rather than in industry or commerce. The result in much of Latin America has been an overrepresentation, sometimes an absolute predominance, of non-Hispanic, non-Portuguese immigrants and their children among the leading commercial and industrial figures of various countries. 20th century studies have shown that more than 40% of the business leaders in Mexico had foreign paternal grandfathers. Among Argentine businessmen prestigious enough to appear in that country's Who's Who, 46% were foreign-born, and many others were the sons of immigrants. In Brazil, a majority of industrial entrepreneurs have been either immigrants or the children of immigrants. Among the heads of large industrial enterprises in Santiago, Chile, about three-quarters were immigrants or the children of immigrants. Even in countries with relatively little immigration, such as Colombia and Peru, immigrants and their children have been heavily represented among industrial entrepreneurs. The disdain for commerce and industry at the higher social levels of Hispanic and Portuguese societies has been paralleled by an aversion to manual labor and hard work at the lower social levels. Such attitudes are not simple laziness, but reflect what one scholar writing on 17th century Spain characterized as a puerile pride in indolence, reflecting an aversion to the stigma of social dishonor associated with manual trades. Similar attitudes could be found centuries later in Spanish and Portuguese offshoot societies in Latin America. Even intellectual work was viewed with disdain by the Brazilian aristocracy. Paraguayans were bewildered by the unrelenting work of Japanese agricultural colonists who settled in their country. Honduran farmers complained that it was unfair for them to have to compete with German farmers in their country, for the latter worked too hard. Brazilian, Chilean, Argentinian, and Paraguayan governments deliberately sought out non-Iberian immigrants for the hard work and severe living needed to pioneer in opening up virgin wilderness in these countries. The point here is not that there is something peculiarly wrong with Iberian culture. What is peculiar is the extremely high productivity of a relative handful of northwestern European nations and their overseas offshoots, such as the United States and Australia, and their Asian counterparts who have borrowed and developed Western technology, Japan being the preeminent example. In an international perspective, it is these prosperous countries which are the exceptions rather than the rule. Beyond this small set of nations, output per capita is sharply lower. Why and how just the right combination of the right factors happened to come together in this small group of nations, quite recently as history is reckoned, is a major unanswered question. Muting these differences with squeamish politeness or waving them aside with cultural relativism seems unlikely to uncover any of the answers. Not only Hispanic and Portuguese cultures, but also the cultures of much of the Third World make business and commerce far less attractive to the educated classes than government employment or work in the professions. The issue is not one of ability in the abstract, or even of concrete skills, nor simply a willingness to engage in economic activities. These activities have their own prerequisites, which are met to varying degrees by different cultures. Clearly, these requirements are met less often, or less well, in cultures where there is a cultural resistance to contractual obligations, where there is a rather plastic sense of the truth, where hypersensitivity to status distinction makes cooperation difficult to achieve in the workplace, where initiative and responsibility are rare, or where notions of accuracy or of cause and effect are hazy. The whole process of scientific abstraction, which lies at the heart of modern technology, is foreign to the mental habits of much, perhaps most, of the human race. Mental testers in a number of countries have noted the difficulty of getting peoples from some cultures even to take abstract questions seriously. The issue of innate ability can hardly even be raised in a context where orientations are so different. Even to test running speed in a foot race, people must first agree to run in the same direction at the same time. Aversions to menial work have likewise varied widely from group to group and from society to society. Japan today is an exception to the common pattern among industrialized nations of importing foreigners to do their menial work. Japan has no difficulty in getting its own people to do such work, which carries no such stigma as elsewhere. By contrast, many people in Sri Lanka continue to have extreme aversions to doing any work with their hands, complicating even the simplest economic tasks. Individuals or groups with values more consonant with the requirements of a modern industrial economy may exist within a given society or enter it from abroad, but whether or not they will have an enduring effect can still be problematical. Where an indigenous and complacent elite is socially powerful enough to absorb dynamic new rising elements on its own terms, for example, to accept wealthy entrepreneurs only insofar as they abandon business for land ownership, this may sterilize these dynamic elements as factors in the general progress of the society. A classic example is the Demidov family, which virtually created the Russian iron and steel industry in the 18th century and supplied half or more of that country's total output for many years, as well as being the leading iron-producing enterprise in all of Europe. The Demidovs were ennobled by the Tsar and ultimately disappeared from commerce and industry into the landed aristocracy. It was common for rising capitalists in Tsarist Russia or Imperial China to aspire to become landed gentry or government officials, and a similar process has marked the history of Spain and of Latin America. Much the same pattern existed in 18th century France, where commercial success seldom lasted three generations in a given family, because wealth led to nobility or public office. Predatory and corrupt government policies and practices toward businessmen, regarded as prey rather than assets, often hasten the transition of entrepreneurs to other roles in such societies. Societies which have historically lacked indigenous entrepreneurship have relied disproportionately on foreign elements who were outside the influence of the social forces which discouraged or diverted indigenous entrepreneurship. This was especially ironic in the case of later imperial and early republican China, whose modern industrial and commercial life were dominated by Europeans and Americans, while a vast overseas Chinese entrepreneurial class flourished elsewhere around the world, unencumbered by the restrictive social patterns of their native land. China was not, however, unique in relying heavily on foreigners for entrepreneurship, trade, and crafts. 16th and 17th century Spain was also heavily dependent on people from other parts of Europe, or from the Islamic world, to fill such occupations, such as Spanish offshoot societies in Latin America would later be dependent on immigrants from non-Hispanic Europe, Asia, or the Middle East to fill such occupations. A similar pattern of heavy dependence on domestic minorities and on foreigners in many economic activities was characteristic of the Ottoman Empire, as well as many countries in Southeast Asia and parts of Africa. Cultural identity. The question of distinctive behavioral traits, values, and ways of thinking is separable from the question of self-conscious identity as a member of a particular ethnic group. One may repudiate one's roots and still exhibit them unwittingly. The conversos, 15th century Spanish converts to Christianity from Judaism, in many cases promoted anti-Semitic policies, but nevertheless worked in the same kinds of occupations and with the same kinds of success as when they had been Jews. Many overseas Chinese in Southeast Asia who considered themselves patriotic Thais or Burmese nevertheless maintained work habits and values that were distinctly Chinese. So have many of the partly Chinese of Southeast Asia, some of whom have been as notoriously anti-Chinese politically as the conversos of Spain were anti-Jewish. Conversely, people who have in fact lost contact with their cultural roots and who have shared little or none of the social experience of their group may not only identify with their group, but even do so in a highly vocal and exaggerated form. It has, in fact, been a common social phenomenon around the world that those who have lost the culture have often been its most strident apostles. Africans educated in Europe and America, and thoroughly westernized in their thinking and values, have been among the most extreme apostles of Pan-Africanism. The concept of negritude originated in Paris among Caribbean emigres. The word Pakistan was coined in Cambridge, England, by Muslim students from the Indian subcontinent. In Peru, it was the acculturated mestizos, rather than the American Indians living in indigenous communities, who lionized the ancestral culture of the Incas. The promotion of Buddhist extremism and Sinhalese chauvinism in Sri Lanka in the 1950s was spearheaded by a westernized, Oxford-educated Christian Sinhalese who grew up unable to speak the language of his own people. Not only have cultural revivals often been led by the most assimilated group members in these and other countries, So have revivals of historic grievances. While first and second generation Japanese in Canada, who personally suffered pervasive discrimination and then internment during the Second World War, showed little lasting resentment in the post-war era, the third generation became very emotionally involved in these events that they did not experience. Among their many laments about the older generation was this: why didn't they tell us what it was like to be a dirty Jap in Canada during the Second World War? Genuine continuity of cultural identity is seldom as strident or as dramatic as artificial revivals. The speaking of Yiddish among many modern Jews has seldom occasioned as much public bombast as the speaking of Gaelic among a handful of modern Irish, or the speaking of Swahili among a handful of American Negroes. Groups such as the Amish in Pennsylvania, or the Mennonites in Canada, the United States, and Mexico, have preserved centuries-old ways of life, almost as in a time capsule, without striking any defiant public poses about it. The principle that a culture is most stridently defended when it is irretrievably lost applies beyond issues of ethnicity. In the United States, it was the generation of Southerners born after the demise of the Confederacy who glorified the lost cause of the Civil War era and its aftermath, as in the motion picture classic Birth of a Nation, the scholarly but apologetic history of U.B. Phillips, and the grand glorification of all, the novel and movie Gone with the Wind. Racial and ethnic cultural identities likewise tend to assume their most ideological form after they are gone with the wind. Exaggerated cultural identity is more than a foible. Among its more serious social consequences are: 1. Putting a dangerous leverage in the hands of extremist fringes within each group, and 2. Stifling the cultural advancement of lagging groups by sealing them off from the cultural advantages of the larger society around them. The problem of putting leverage in the hands of extremists is the greatest immediate danger, though cultural provincialism can take a heavy toll in the long run. Even if 90% of both Group A and Group B consist of well-meaning people with no real animosity toward the other group, the way that they respond to clashes between their respective hostile fringes can differ greatly according to the degree of group identity and solidarity within each group. Where identity and solidarity are at a fever pitch, every such clash can be seen as a sign of a larger threat by one group as a whole against the other group as a whole, whereas in quieter times, both groups might see the same episodes as the work of hooligans or demagogues whom most members of both groups disdain. The social cost of exaggerated identity can be very high to the groups involved and to the whole society. The long-run costs of exaggerated identity can be especially high to groups lagging behind their contemporaries in education, income, and all the social consequences that flow from these. Throughout history, one of the great sources of cultural achievement, both for groups and for nations, and even civilizations, has been a borrowing of cultural features from others who happen to be more advanced in given fields at a given time. Medieval Jews in Spain copied the science and mathematics developed in the Islamic world, and only later began to make their own original contributions. Western civilization as a whole absorbed both technologies and science from China and the Islamic world, including parts of the Indian subcontinent, as the foundation for its own ascent to world leadership in these fields. In the 20th century, Japan was long known for its cheap and shoddy imitations of European and American products, before it eventually emerged as a world leader, both quantitatively and qualitatively, in developing many products it had once copied. Exaggerated group identity makes copying others akin to treason. Even groups already speaking a language common to a billion of their contemporaries on Earth, English, and encompassing a vast literature in science, philosophy, and other fields, have been urged to abandon that language for an ancestral tongue which most no longer speak, which is spoken nowhere else on the planet, and which has little or no literature. In the case of the Maoris in New Zealand, the argument has even been made that Maori should become the official language of the whole country. In Malaysia, English has been abandoned as the language of higher education, even though it is a language so widely read there that the country's leading newspaper, the New Straits Times, is published in English. Where separate group identities are government-subsidized, often under the general label of multiculturalism in Australia, Britain, Canada, and the United States, an artificial balkanization is fostered in utter disregard of the tragic historic consequences of balkanization in many parts of Asia and Africa, as well as in the Balkans themselves.